So good evening, everyone. Really delighted to be here with all of you for one of your Discovering Buddhism classes on this module on refuge. So I guess page 34, and we'll just start with the taking refuge, and then do you do the four immeasurables as well? Okay. So again, this course is about refuge, and we'll be talking about that tonight, obviously, that topic. So let's just recite these words in English tonight, but recognizing that all of this pertains to our own sense of safe direction that we find in the three jewels. And so some of you may have been studying Buddhism longer than others, but it's really quite personal for each of you then to look at this as you recite these words, I go for refuge and so on, as to what sense of confidence you have in this path and the three jewels, and just bringing that to mind as you recite these words. So they aren't just empty words. They're ways of reaffirming our own commitment to this path to whatever degree we have that. So let's recite that three times together. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So now we can visualize all sentient beings surrounding us. It's kind of an overwhelming task, but think as many beings as you can imagine in the space around you, just going out in all directions. And we're going to cultivate these four immeasurable thoughts and pause after each of these just to try to cultivate that thought for as many of these beings as we can. And we might start with those that are very close to us, friends, dear ones, and then we might think about those who are strangers, who we might not have any particular emotion towards. And then if we can, to even extend that to the difficult people in our lives, those who challenge us. So let's recite each of these, and we'll start with the first line, which is immeasurable love. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. And then we cultivate the companion of immeasurable compassion. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. And then what we call immeasurable joy, kind of taking delight and joy in all beings in this state of being inseparable from complete happiness with no suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And then finally, immeasurable equanimity. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Okay, so is that all the prayers you normally do? Okay, good. That's probably good enough for tonight. Let's just do a short meditation then before we begin. Just give us a chance to come into this space fully, not just with our bodies, but with our minds. And then we'll generate a good motivation for being here. So again, most of you, I'm sure, have some instruction in meditation, so I don't need to say a whole lot. But just find a good meditation posture, making sure there is this uprightness to the body, the back straight, and yet releasing any tension in the body as well. Just settling into a nice posture. And when you're ready, you can begin to do a meditation on the breath. So if you already have one that you go to that you use frequently, you can do that. If not, I'll suggest working with the point at the tip of the nose, that subtle sensation that occurs just inside the nostrils as you breathe in and as you breathe out. That's the basic instruction. When you see that the mind has wandered from the breath, then without any judgment, just simply let go of whatever it was that distracted you and bring the awareness back to the breath, just allowing that distraction to kind of cease of its own accord. And then if we see the mind wanders again, we simply do the same. So I'll ring the chime, and we'll do this in silence for just a few minutes, and then I'll lead you in a short reflection to set motivation for tonight. So now to set our motivation for this evening's class, let's just take a moment to recall the stages of the path. So I'm sure most of you are already familiar with the Lam Rim and how these three levels of motivation are set out. So prior to having some exposure to the Lam Rim, we may have been primarily concerned with our own welfare right now here in this life. And a preoccupation with that isn't even really practicing the path. And while we might gain some immediate benefit from being here tonight and having the Buddha's teachings in our lives, this shouldn't be the extent of our motivation, simply the happiness of this life. Rather, we should at least have the first level of motivation of these three, which is some concern for what happens in our next existence. Due to the fact that the mind is continuous, when this life ceases, our consciousness will go on. We'll unite with another form, another body, another existence. And out of our own concern for ourselves and our future welfare, we should want to be here to strengthen our sense of refuge and commitment to the three jewels and this Buddhist path so that we can avoid such unfortunate rebirths and end up in a good state, a state as good as or even better than the one we currently possess. All the conditions complete for us to continue to experience happiness, but moreover to use those lives in meaningful ways, just like we're trying to use this one in a meaningful way. So this is the first level of motivation, and just hold that thought for a short while, thinking that you're here to create the causes for a good rebirth, a good existence when this one ceases. Then there's the second level, where we advance our awareness to encompass the big picture, the fact that each of us are going from life to life under the control of various factors, our karma, our delusions. And we've been doing this since beginningless time. Even if we get a good rebirth, we will still be subject to that level of dissatisfaction, never being able to have any true peace and happiness, always going from existence to existence, experiencing the wide array of sufferings, of unsatisfactory experiences. So we can be here as well to explore this topic of refuge with that level of motivation that seeks to be free from that cycle of existence, that seeks to find true peace and nirvana in one's own individual liberation, one's own pacification of suffering and all the causes of suffering. To try to hold that thought for just a moment, thinking, in addition, you're also here to create the causes for that result, to learn more about refuge so you can accomplish your own freedom from suffering once and for all. And then we finally reach the third level, the highest level of motivation, which is ideally what we should be bringing to these teachings, is recognizing that we're not alone in our predicament. Every other being, everyone else in this room, every being in Raleigh, every being in North Carolina, every being in this country, in this world, in all realms of existence, is in the exact same situation as you. And moreover, because we are interdependent with all these beings, our happiness depends upon them. It would be really short-sighted if we were to neglect their welfare at this time. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could be of greatest benefit to all these beings? And the Buddha says that we can, if we turn our attention, our motivation towards the goal of enlightenment, of Buddhahood, and think that we're going to go beyond our own personal liberation to achieve a state where we can truly help others, being fully capable, fully imbued with perfect wisdom and perfect compassion, perfect power. Try to set that most altruistic and powerful motivation for being here, wanting to explore refuge so that you can accomplish that goal of your own enlightenment to lead all beings to that same state. So, where do I start? I talked with Shankha a little bit about what he requested that I cover to some extent. And so I think I'm going to kind of stick to that to some degree, though he also said it might be nice if I give some impressions from my own experience about refuge and what that means. I hear that all of you have the opportunity this Friday, if you have decided to take refuge with Geshe Gelug here. And that's really wonderful, especially to do it on such an auspicious day of Sakadawa. So I think it's important to have some idea of what's involved in refuge. You already have gained a lot of that through, I'm sure, the last several classes that you've had here. I mean, my own experience with refuge was in 1993, I began studying Buddhism primarily through Sogyal Rinpoche's book, which I'm sure some of you in the room have read, a book called The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. Very powerful book for me at the time. I was experiencing some grief from losses in my life and looking for kind of what's the meaning of life, that perennial question that so many people are questing to have an answer to. And came upon that book, and it really answered so many questions for me. And I happened to go on retreat with Sogyal Rinpoche. He was in California. I was living in San Francisco at the time. And he came to a wonderful retreat center called Mount Madonna Center that fall of 93. And there were something like 500 people at this retreat. It was huge, really amazing. And at the very end of it, after 10 days of teaching with him and already having found within myself some real conviction that this was the path I wanted to follow, it just made sense to me. It felt like a good fit. It felt like it was answering all the questions that I had in ways that I could find satisfactory and even inspiring for me in terms of how I wanted to live my life. And so at the very end, Sogyal Rinpoche said, okay, he said, some of the students have asked if I could offer refuge, who all wants to take refuge. And so we all stood up, and there were like hundreds of people standing up taking refuge together with him. And I don't even remember all of it. I remember at the point where he snaps his fingers, you know, and it felt very special to kind of feel kind of entering into that path in a formal way. But refuge isn't just that ceremony and that clicking of the fingers or something. I mean, refuge is obviously all the thoughts that build into that moment, but also that continue after that moment. And I think it was Lama Yeshe, and maybe you've heard this before, but he describes it as doing refuge rather than taking refuge. And the whole idea is that refuge is something we're doing all the time. So since that moment when the finger snapped 1993, all those years ago, it's just been a process of doing refuge, which means finding ways to, throughout our days, throughout our lives, always seeing how can I frame this in the context of the Buddha's teachings? How can I actually utilize these precious teachings that we receive through the Buddha Dharma into a way of living my life? And for me, of course, lots of doors started unfolding, and I had the good fortune to be able to exit my corporate job in San Francisco and go off and study in Italy for the 7 years I was there, and now being a Dharma teacher for these last 11 years or so. And it really, you know, again, I'm not saying everyone's life is going to look like that. All of our paths are going to be different, but it's all a manifestation of refuge. It's all a manifestation of this, not just feeling, but a real conviction within our hearts that what we have found is something that will lead to greater happiness and well-being. Yeah, it might at times feel like it's primarily for ourselves, but it also manifests in terms of we know that this will also be good for others. We know that it'll be good for the people that are in our lives, whoever they might be, whether they're Buddhist or not. It'll be good for the world at large to have more and more people living from the space of what these teachings are about, rooted in nonviolence, rooted in compassion and wisdom. So I think that it becomes like an ever-blossoming thing. Refuge isn't a point in time. Refuge is a whole process. That's why I really like that phrase that Lama Yeshe used of doing refuge. It's really a continual process. And maybe you've heard this from other people before, but I'm just wanting to share my own perspective in that regard. So every time you recite those words, it's kind of interesting. This is a device that's used frequently in Tibetan Buddhism and probably in other Buddhist traditions to recite things three times. And it's kind of nice because you should feel a little more conviction each time you say it. It's not, oh, God, I got to say it again and again and again. It's like I get to reaffirm this three times and make it kind of really mean something, hopefully by the third time. Sometimes when you say it just one time, it doesn't have quite the force behind it. But this is what we're doing in our lives as well, is every time that we have our own sense of refuge in the Buddha's teachings. And it doesn't mean just by reciting that verse or something. It means when we find that in that moment we can apply those teachings, it's like reaffirming again and again what that sense of refuge is really all about. So maybe that's enough on that. I want to approach what we're going to cover tonight in terms of using the document that you have. I think most of you picked one up on the way in. There's on the table there if you didn't get these. There's two documents that I brought in that I prepared. One is called the 12 Refuge Commitments. These are what I use when I teach on refuge in our Discovering Buddhism program in Santa Fe and in Taos at the center north of Santa Fe. The one that we're going to use as the main document is the 12 Refuge Commitments. And then the other one is a meditation that I put together that encompasses what are frequently called the 8 benefits of taking refuge. And I'm going to touch on those a little bit later, because they're actually part of our commitments, is to remember it's the 4th of the 6 common guidelines. Okay. Maybe I'll give it a moment just for Aaron to do that, and then I'll continue. So that way everyone's got what I'm working with. No problem. Just let Aaron know if you need a copy when she's coming by. Do we have enough copies, you think, for everyone? Okay. And there's also in the back, Colleen needs one. So just as a prelude to this, while it's being distributed, these 12 refuge commitments pretty much mirror what is in Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand. But the wording is taken primarily from what Venerable Thupten Chodron has on her website. I've given the link there for going to her teachings on refuge. Actually, if you go to that, I think it gives you all the teachings on the Lam Rim that she has at her website. But you can find the ones on refuge and kind of review them there if you'd like to. I think most of you probably have a copy of Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, the Lam Rim text that is used for discovering Buddhism. And I've given you the page references to examine those there as well. And that's from the 2006 edition, which is the larger blue one that I think most of you probably have. So again, these commitments, it's kind of interesting. You know, what is the difference between a commitment and a vow? Because vows are also something that Geshe La will probably offer. I'm pretty sure that he'll be offering the 5 lay vows, and I may touch on those a little bit. They're actually in your prayer book, so I can go to that if I need to. But a vow is maybe, again, a little bit stronger. It's not to say that we should think that commitments are something we don't need to pay attention to, but it doesn't seem that, and this is something that is actually mentioned in some of the Lam Rim texts, is that to really break your refuge commitment in terms of what you would be doing by initially taking refuge and then any time you take it subsequent to that to reaffirm your refuge, that you really don't break that refuge commitment unless you do something pretty serious in terms of really turning away from refuge in the Three Jewels, pretty much what's number 6 on the 6 common guidelines, the very last one on your page, is if you do forsake your refuge, if you do have that strong mind that turns completely away from the Three Jewels and just says, sorry, it ain't there for me, this is not my path, I don't care for all this, and you move in another direction that's totally opposed to that, that's really what it means to lose your refuge. Nonetheless, all of these are really important to uphold and strengthen our refuge. And what I like about the Buddha's teachings, even when we look at vows, which again do have a little bit stronger connotation to them, people sometimes think, oh God, it's like another thing I have to carry around and remember. But they actually are tools that are really useful. They give us kind of a clear delineation. It's sort of like getting your GPS for how to go to Buddhahood or something. You're getting the exact tracking that will help you follow this path. So when we take vows or commitments, whatever they might be, it's to help us to know more clearly what the way is, what the path is. So it's a wonderful tool, a navigation tool, to help us to move in the direction that we want to move in, ideally. So at the level of taking refuge, and by the way, when you do take refuge, if you make that decision to do that, you're really taking refuge as a Buddhist. You're not taking refuge as a Tibetan Buddhist or anything else. This is given by a Tibetan master who you do now have a special relationship to as your preceptor. But it's not given in terms of you are now Tibetan Buddhist, like it's branding you in that particular way. It's just a way of entering into the Buddha's teachings in a formal manner. Again, we should already feel we've got some sense of that refuge within our hearts, and that's really what's more important than the ceremony. The ceremony is a way of kind of externalizing some of that, and it's a nice way to do that because it does feel somewhat special to recite those words and make that commitment in public with other practitioners in your community. But nonetheless, know that again, this is really just a personal decision, and once you make that decision and take refuge, you simply become a Buddhist. It doesn't mean that, oh, I took refuge in Tibetan Buddhism, now I've got to be a Tibetan Buddhist. I can't be a Zen Buddhist or a Theravadan Buddhist or whatever. It's really simply entering the door to the Buddha's teachings in that formal way. So these 12 guidelines that are set out here that are what we call our refuge commitments, as I said, are ways of strengthening our refuge. They're set up in two groups of six. The first six, as you can see, are quite specific to the three jewels, which you've explored through this course, right? Knowing what the Buddha jewel is, the Dharma jewel, the Sangha jewel. And they're technically set out in terms of what are called proscriptive and prescriptive, each of them having one of each. Proscriptive meaning this is something you have to avoid, and prescriptive meaning something that you're encouraged to practice, to actually engage in. The other six are what are called common guidelines. Now, what's kind of interesting, and I've never gotten an answer from anybody in the FPMT as to why this is so, but if you go to where in the book where this is set out, and it's in the section called Taking Refuge in the Three Jewels, if you go to page 115 of the prayer book, and it might be useful to have this open to this, you'll see that there are the three that we're going to talk about, what is to be avoided. These are proscriptive for each of the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. What is to be practiced, these are prescriptive rather than the previous that were proscriptive for Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. They continue on to page 116. And for some reason, there's only 4 points of general advice. And I never was clear about why that's so. And actually, it does seem like they're even a little bit different. And in any particular branch of Buddhism, you might get some slight differences in terms of some of this. I would really encourage you, as much as possible, to try to embody what's in these six common guidelines. And certainly, you can also follow what's in the four. There is some duplication there, but I think it's worthwhile to just know that, in general, in this tradition, these six common guidelines are the way that we really uphold our refuge in all three jewels. So any questions on that preliminary before going into the actual specific commitments? Is everyone clear on kind of what these are about? I mean, we should feel, again, some confidence as I go through these that we can do these, but also recognizing that, again, this isn't, you know, a make or break it type of thing. It's something we have to grow into. And so there may be days where we go, oh my gosh, I didn't do this or I didn't do that. And that's okay. You know, just pick yourself up, keep doing what you do. We don't have to beat ourselves up for a lot of these things. When it comes to vows, again, those are a little more serious, and we may have to engage in a purification practice in regard to some of that. And I think most of you were here for the previous module, Module 6 of Discovering Buddhism on Karma. Okay, so you probably learned purification there. It's a valuable thing to have, just to be able to clean up the ways that we maybe haven't upheld our vows, or upheld even our general behavior in regard to the three jewels. So let's look at the two that are at the top of the page here. Again, they are the proscriptive, so would be the first of what is to be avoided on page 115, and also at the bottom there, the first for the what is to be practiced on 115. So with regard to the Buddha jewel, I'm going to read what's on the sheet. It says, having taken refuge in the Buddha, who has purified all defilements, and all qualities, do not turn for refuge to worldly deities who lack the capacity to guide you from all problems. So again, the idea here is that it doesn't mean that we kind of put all of our faith in the Buddha Dharma, or the Buddha in particular, without recognizing that at times in our lives we'll need to also have some faith and conviction in other things. This means that when it comes down to it in terms of our spiritual practice, we really see that the Buddha's path and what the Buddha teaches and who the Buddha is as a being who has done this work of purifying everything that is negative, advancing everything that is positive, that this is our reliable guide. So for example, I mean, you know, the people turn to various people for aid in their lives. Like if you were ill, you wouldn't sit there and just keep praying to the Buddha, you know, please cure me from my illness, cure me from my sickness. You would go to the doctor, right? Because the doctor has the medical knowledge that can maybe diagnose you more clearly at the moment to help you to actually take the medicine that will alleviate that suffering. So it doesn't mean that we put 100% of our reliance upon the Buddha and expect that the Buddha is going to fix everything for us. This is a matter of us using our own discernment and wisdom and making decisions about how we need to deal with life's challenges. But the bottom line when it comes to our spiritual decisions is that we do rely upon the Buddha, that we see the Buddha as a reliable guide. And that's based on, again, your own study and understanding of the qualities of a Buddha, that a Buddha is at that place of full development, complete purification. There's nothing that's clouding the mind of a Buddha. There's nothing absent from a Buddha's mind that will be useful and helpful. So again, you might think, well, but how do I relate to a Buddha? Well, that, again, is a module that we teach here as well. That it's, I think you probably did it in the... Do you normally do that in the normal order, module 4? Module 4 is the spiritual teacher module.
Normally that comes before this, but we were due for that one that I wanted
okay. Refuge first. Because it was coming up. So you're going to do that one next?
Immediately next.
Okay. Good. So you'll get a chance to explore that soon. In Tibetan Buddhism in particular, we try to see that our spiritual guides, potentially, particularly at certain levels of practice, are the Buddhas for us, are someone who exemplifies that type of wisdom and compassion, purification and qualities in our lives. So you'll be exploring that soon. But just know that, again, we might feel somewhat distant from the Buddhas, but the Buddhas are actually finding ways to help us all the time. So when it comes down to our own sense of where do we turn to for protection, we should feel very confident that the Buddha is a reliable person for that. And this is as opposed to, uses the phrase here, worldly deities. Again, this is more rooted in things that are taught within the Eastern cultures. We don't maybe have quite as much conviction in that in the West. But we don't look to other sources that are not enlightened. We want an enlightened being to be our ultimate refuge because this is the epitome, the perfection of what we're trying to practice ourselves. So again, that's the idea behind it. Venerable Thupten Chodron, in her teachings on refuge, she shares a cute little story. I don't know if it translates into Western culture quite as much. A lot of these Tibetan stories don't. But this one I thought was kind of interesting. There was this man who had a goiter. That's the second part. Yeah, no, that's the first part. Man has a goiter, and he's out, walking from one destination to the next. And I think all of this stuff happens with like rain and storms and all that, and he needs a safe place of refuge. And there happens to be this like worldly kind of mundane being that he takes refuge in, and the being has this, it's like a cannibal type of being, and it ends up eating his goiter in like payment for allowing the man to have refuge there. And so the man's very happy, you know, because he lost his goiter. He feels like he's got great confidence in this being. And he happens to tell one of his friends that this happened to him, and his friend has a goiter. And so his friend goes there thinking that he's going to have the same protection and this being will actually take away his goiter. And the being apparently didn't like the taste of the first goiter. So the man ends up getting kind of two goiters or something like that. So the gist of it is we have to be careful who we put our faith in, right? You know? I think this is meant to be seen in our Western world is maybe, again, just to recognize that there's a lot of things that we do put our confidence in. I think this was part of this module for you as well, is to look at what we do as worldly refuge, mundane refuge, ordinary kinds of refuge, and to make sure that we don't kind of place all our money, all of our bets on that type of being or thing. I mean, some people might pay more attention to their horoscope than they do to the Buddhist advice that we receive here. This would obviously not be a way of, that would be in line with this or opposed to this, where we're actually taking refuge in more worldly advice that may not even protect us from any form of suffering, whereas what the Buddha teaches in terms of the teachings on karma and so on will absolutely protect you from suffering. So any questions on that first one? Let's go on to the prescriptive one. This is where we receive some positive advice about what to do in regard to the Buddha jewel. Here it says, respect all images of the Buddha. Do not put them in low or dirty places. Step over them. Point your feet towards them. Sell them to earn a living or use them as collateral. When looking at various images, do not discriminate. This Buddha is beautiful, but this one is not. Do not treat with respect expensive and impressive statues while neglecting those that are damaged or less costly. So you might think, well, what is this all about? I mean, what does that have to do with my sense of refuge? There's going to be some of these with the prescriptive advice where we actually recognize that the objects themselves aren't harmed by that. It's not like the Buddhas are going, ah, you hurt me by, you know, stepping over me or doing something bad to me. It has to do with our own sense of respect and reverence for what we are holding our confidence and faith in. So when we have these sorts of prescriptive ones of trying to respect all of these images of a Buddha, it has to do with our own mindset. How are we seeing those things? You know, they do say that any image that we see of a Buddha, and if you had like the children's program here, if one of the children were to draw what they see as a Buddha, even though it's like this scribbly little line that doesn't look anything like a Buddha, if they say, look at the Buddha that I drew, we should hold that with the same reverence as, you know, the statue that's behind me. We shouldn't be seeing it as somehow different because it is an image of the Buddha that represents for us where our real sense of refuge is, this being one of the three jewels. So again, it's kind of hard to have that kind of mindset. And if you're in the shop looking or you're out, you know, on the internet looking and you're looking for a statue to buy or a tanka to buy, and you might think, oh, well, this one's really attractive, that one isn't so attractive. This isn't a really healthy way to work with our minds because we should ideally see them all as having the same embodiment of the qualities that a Buddha possesses, the same level of purification that a Buddha represents. Lama Atisha himself was asked once, somebody brought him like a Manjushri statue or something and said, Lama Atisha, can you please tell me your assessment of this statue? And he says, well, it's a statue of Manjushri, so there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, it's already perfect. He says, as for the person who made the statue, mediocre quality. You know? So you can talk about it in terms of the beings who might have made that or created that, painted that, and so on. But the image itself is meant to be held in a high regard. Once more, this doesn't have to do with the image needing that, the Buddha's needing that. This has to do with how are we looking at that? I mean, look at how dear people hold pictures of their loved ones, right? You don't just like trample all over them and leave them on the floor. You leave them in a nice place of respect because you care about those beings in your life. You know, you'd be quite hurt if you went to somebody's house and there was your picture, you know, lying on the floor getting trampled on, right? You'd feel like, well, wow, you don't think that much of me to put it in a frame in a nice place. Well, if we do that for the people that we care about in our lives, why would we not do that for Buddhas? So again, this is maybe a little bit tough one for us to work with, but the implication of doing it is that we will have a different sense about what the Buddhas are for us, what that represents, and use it as a source then for inspiring us in our lives. This idea of kind of selling them to earn a living, using them as collateral, I don't know that many of us will have an opportunity to do that, but it's certainly good to be mindful of that. To what extent are we treating them as either just objects of trade, or even what a lot of people do, which is make them into objects of art. I mean, they're sacred art. They are art, but they're sacred art. And so we shouldn't be treating them in that way. If you do happen to have Buddha statues and hang tankas, you know, in a place that's other people are seeing them and they're part of your decor, well, you still should have a very high respect for them and not treat them just as the same as a painting or a print or something that you have on the walls. Ideally, they're meant to be kept in a sacred area. And you should, if you don't already, it's nice to have at least a portion of your house, some corner of a room, if not an entire room, devoted to where you do your practice, where those images can be there to inspire you. That's what they're there for. They're there to kind of help us bring to mind the influences on our life that we want to feel and the way in which you want to practice to become like those beings, to see them as an embodiment of our own potential, our own qualities. This is that idea that I think you've touched on in refuge already as well, what we call causal refuge versus resultant refuge. Causal meaning those beings who are outside of ourselves that the statues represent, that are there as aids in our practice, helping us to develop our path. Whereas we also have the resultant refuge, which is our own future Buddhahood. You know, our own development into the same qualities that that being represents, that that statue represents. So I think it's important in terms of our practice to just really do what we can to care for images in this way, to clean them frequently. This is part of having a good altar. You'll get that in Module 8 when you look at establishing a daily practice, is what it means to have a dedicated place of practice and using that day in and day out. But to certainly take care of these images, respect them, because they do represent something special. They shouldn't just be thrown in a box with knickknacks and all kinds of other things. You should be holding them in high regard. Probably beating a dead horse on this one, but any questions on that? Okay. Let's go on to the Dharma Jewel then. And here too, we have one that's proscriptive, that's telling us what not to do, and then the other one that's telling us what to do. And this is perhaps one of the most important of the refuge commitments, is this first one for the Dharma Jewel. Having taken refuge in the Dharma, avoid harming any living being. Again, now this is, if we take it purely on those words, it would be pretty hard to avoid being involved in the harm to any being. Even if you're vegan, and you think, oh, I'm getting away from all the harm that's caused by killing animals for their meat or utilizing animals for their byproducts. There's still countless beings that are killed in producing vegetables, right? So you cannot get away from being complicit to some degree in the harm of other beings. This is really about our doing intentional harm ourselves or through encouraging others to do harm on our behalf to other beings. So we don't want to engage in those direct activities as much as possible. And then we can avoid indirect ones to the degree that we're comfortable. But, you know, if we have an opportunity where we can make a decision, a choice between saving the life of a being or taking the life of a being, we should opt for saving its life, protecting its life, as opposed to taking it. So once more, each of us in the room is probably going to be at a different place in regard to this. We talked about this a little over the weekend in the teachings that I did, that it's very hard to completely sign up for some of these things because we might still have a proclivity towards swatting mosquitoes or going fishing or whatever the case might be, ways that beings are harmed by virtue of our actions. But what you're making a commitment here to is doing the best that you can to live up to this type of ideal. We should feel somewhat comfortable kind of trying that on and taking that perspective. As I mentioned over the weekend, I think we have to get real creative in how we maintain our commitment in that way. This is really, as I said, one of the fundamental teachings of the Buddha. There's this wonderful Sanskrit word ahimsa, which is non-harmfulness, which is really what all the Buddha's teachings are based on and all of the teachings on morality are rooted in, is that we don't want to harm others. Certainly we don't want to harm ourselves as well, but we want this regard for other beings. And this is what defines something that is going against the Buddha's morality, in essence, is that if it's something that harms others, then it's not so virtuous. So we really do want to try to avoid this as much as possible. So we have to get creative. You have to find ways to protect yourself from those situations where you would be tempted to kill a mosquito or whatever. If you're fishing, I don't know, catch and release is always one of these questions that comes up too around fishing. It's better than killing the being. It's still harming the being to some degree. I mean, I don't know. Someone said, oh, fish don't really feel it, but I don't know if I believe that or not. I never was fishing. I just was nothing I was ever exposed to. I know this is hard if we have these habits of fishing or hunting or what have you. But I think we each have to make that commitment. If this is the path we're following of non-harmfulness, and we've already had, again, the teachings on karma that show us that so many of our unskillful actions are involved in that, harming other beings, taking their things, taking their lives, you know, lying to them, deceiving them, and so on. So any questions on that one? I feel like I need to stop here because this is probably the one that might be challenging perhaps for some people. I don't know, maybe not. It is a bit of a tall order to say, I'm going to live my life by this principle. Yeah.
I have a question.
Okay, hold on just 1 second. We'll get a microphone. Aaron, I'll get you a microphone, Naga.
I have the question on the Brahma, such as letting go Brahma, right?
Okay.
In the book.
Oh, in the book, yeah, on that first one.
Mm-hmm. So I know Buddhism doesn't believe in Brahma, but other religions do.
Sure.
Sorry.
Okay.
So in that case, any other god for any other religion, then they're asking them
well,
to...
The way that it's worded, I think, by Geshe Sopa when he talks about this in his commentary on the refuge precepts or refuge commitments, is that it doesn't mean that you if you had, for example, a teaching by Jesus Christ that is embodying the same ideals that Buddha is teaching, there's nothing wrong with following things that are consistent with the Dharma. We're not looking to, like, say, everything is wrong, only Buddhism is right. Rather that we're trying to live by Buddhist ideals, so we don't want to adopt anything that's going to be potentially contradictory to what we're trying to practice in Buddhism. So again, these sorts of putting faith or taking refuge in different gods or different spiritual figures in other traditions is more about whether we are kind of finding what's our bottom line. When it comes down to it, where is it that we're really resting? And this does mean that we have to make a decision at some time what our sort of bottom line path is. You know, and if we aren't feeling yet that we're at a bottom line, that we still are entertaining ideas that other paths may be preferable or optimal as opposed to Buddhism, then perhaps we're not ready yet to take refuge. The idea behind that first one about, you know, not taking, looking for refuge to Brahma and so on is really just to recognize the strength that we need of conviction in this path so that we aren't swayed by moving to another path, kind of changing tracks, and thinking that there's nothing wrong with that. Because we've made the decision to choose this as our path, we should feel quite content and committed to continuing to pursue that. Does that clarify a little bit, or does it bring more questions? Or? Okay. But again, in terms of following other teachings, I think we can find that there's many useful teachings from other traditions that aren't labeled Buddhist. I mean, if we look at what the word Dharma means, because we're, you know, also talking about the Dharma jewel, Dharma is that which protects you or holds you back from suffering. There's lots of good teachings out there in different traditions that help us to do that. If it's consistent with Buddhist thinking and something that is an extension of that and complements that, no problem. His Holiness the Dalai Lama was asked once at a teaching I was at in Milan in 1999, of course, a predominantly Catholic country, and then many Catholics in the audience listening to His Holiness's teachings. And one person asked, you know, who is Jesus Christ according to Buddhist teachings? And His Holiness said, well, because of the profound impact that Jesus Christ has had on the morality and practice of so many people in this world, you have to be a bodhisattva if not a Buddha. You know, have to be a high bodhisattva or Buddha that could have that level of positive impact on people in this world. So when it comes down to it and you go, well, then what is Dharma? You know, if Dharma is a teaching of a Buddha and you say Jesus Christ is a Buddha, well, then is what Jesus Christ taught also Buddha Dharma? I don't know. It starts to get a little gray in those areas. But I think we have to once more use what is our bottom line, the Buddha's teachings, and then we compare what we learn from other traditions that might be useful for us to, are they consistent with the Buddha's teachings? Do they complement it and there's no problem in following them? Well, then they're an extension of the Dharma in a sense. Not to say that, again, that's our final refuge and we go to that being and that faith for our bottom line. Our bottom line still is Buddhism. But we can learn a lot from other people and their faith and what they have and have to offer. But we just are acknowledging that the real refuge for us on that first one, the real refuge for us is the Buddha. Because the Buddha is the ultimate guide. Now, who is a Buddha? That becomes a bigger issue, like I said. Maybe Jesus Christ is a Buddha. Maybe Krishna is a Buddha. Maybe Muhammad is a Buddha. I don't know. So it's up for us to sort of check up on those. But our bottom line is we are going to take refuge in Buddhas not just the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, which is often worded as, but really Buddha is any being who has fully developed their mind to that degree. Okay. Yes.
Thank you.
Guillermo.
It's a little bit following this comment.
Uh-huh.
No?
Uh-huh.
I was thinking in the Star Wars movie.
Uh-huh.
When you, and it's also a personal question to you. In
uh-huh.
terms of the may the force be with you.
Uh-huh.
So the force, in terms of the Buddhist approach.
Right.
You see, you think in terms of the main things in the Buddhist, the little thing that I know at this point.
Uh-huh.
But it's like I could say a framework where you have different realms, no?
Different, I'm sorry.
Realms.
Okay, yes.
And then, let's see, we are in one of them. And
right.
Buddha was able to escape to this and go mm-hmm. to another that is more not subject to this one.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing with this, the force be with you, could be some kind of framework of this framework. So it's more mm-hmm. the, I could say the life force in certain way that is mm-hmm. more underlying everything. Or let's see, you say, I am aware
mm-hmm.
of my thoughts.
Right.
I am not my thoughts, I am just aware of my thoughts.
Uh-huh.
So if we could connect that in certain way that we are the awareness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this awareness could be kind of the force, or we could. So the thing is, if
right.
there is a missing thing that perhaps is uh-huh. not contradicting the Buddha teachings, no?
I don't know. There was actually a book once called The Dharma of Star Wars. I didn't read it, so I don't know if I have an answer from that book. There's lots of different ways of talking about, I suppose, if we say, and they often say that all the good there is in the world, all of what is positive and wholesome and helpful is a derivation of the Buddha's enlightened activities, that what we mean by enlightened mind, which isn't really a different realm. You use the word realm, but realm almost implies like a physical place that beings are at. And the Buddha isn't in some kind of other physical space while we're here. And I mean, the Buddha is pervading everywhere because Buddha is that awareness that has an omniscient mind knowing all phenomena. A bit like what people mean by God, I think, in the theistic traditions, is a being who has that all-pervasive quality. So if we think about that being everything that is a manifestation of what is good and wholesome in the world is a byproduct of the enlightened activities of enlightened beings. Maybe we could call that the force or whatever, and we were trying to align ourselves more closely with that in the world. I think it's a bit of what we're doing by taking refuge, is to say that that is where we see our safe direction. By the way, these words safe direction are what Alex Berzin uses frequently as a translation for taking refuge. That's actually a nice way to think about it if you were to recite the prayer and say, I take safe direction in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Kind of implies that you found something that is safe, that is capable of saving you even, that is having that connotation. And it's a direction. It's a place giving us exactly where we want to go, but I don't know if I can say more on that because I'm not sure I have the knowledge to be able to do more than that, but it's one way to think about it, and I don't think it's counter to what I'm saying. So, good. Thanks, Gemma. Let's continue on. Let's look at the next one that is, again, a bit more prescriptive. It says there also, respect the written words which describe the path to enlightenment by keeping the texts clean and in a high place. Avoid stepping over them, putting them on the floor, or throwing them in the rubbish when they are old. It is best to burn or recycle old Dharma materials. Now, I'm putting recycle in there because actually Venerable Thupten Chodron says that. In our tradition, I don't know, sometimes I hear about just burning them. Like if you have old Dharma notes or something that you don't need any longer, maybe you took the notes and then you put them in your computer. It is best, I think, to burn them. But in the world that we live in, again, the time of the Buddha, there weren't so many written materials, right? We've got so much now. it's very hard to, and it's hard on the environment to continually be burning things and what have you. The one thing you definitely don't want to do is throw them in the trash. Just think, treat them like garbage, because they do represent, again, the Buddha's teachings and the importance of those in your own life. Again, the Dharma isn't going to be offended by you doing that. It has to do with your own mind, just like the second one on the Buddha jewel. It is good to have your Dharma materials in a somewhat high, respectful place. Don't put things above them or on top of them. One teacher even told me once, don't, if you have a Dharma book, even like the prayer book, don't put, you know, even a mala, you know, a rosary, Buddhist rosary, certainly not pencils or anything like that. And why you do this once more is because your mind associates differently when you treat the Dharma like that. Kind of keeping yourself open to receiving greater influence from the Dharma when you treat the Dharma materials like that. So it's not, again, that anyone's offended by doing that. You might have Dharma police coming around to our centers that give you a ticket, but they don't really. But the idea is that we're changing our minds and how we're seeing it. So we don't have, you know, some trashy novel right next to our Lam Rim text. You know, we treat our Lam Rim text as being something much more important than that. We put our trashy novel way down at the bottom or maybe in the trash. I don't know if I want to say a whole lot more about that. Let me just see if, again, any questions on that one. Again, this is all about our minds. Yeah, we have the mic for Barry. Thanks.
Yeah, I have mala beads that have gotten broken and there's like so many missing now.
Uh-huh.
What will you do with those?
Oh, geez, I don't know if I've ever been asked that question. I mean, it's useful if you can make them into another mala. You know, maybe obtain some beads that are comparable and re-thread them. That way they don't go to waste. You know, a mala itself is something that we bless. It's not as much of a holy object as a statue or an image. It, nonetheless, it should be treated somewhat respectfully, any of our sort of Dharma implements and things that we use in our practice. I mean, some people who have a mandala set might take some beads from their mala when it breaks and put them in their mandala set. I don't think there's any problem with that. Some of you have seen the mandala sets. It's a set that you use with various beads and things, precious, semi-precious stones, and you create what's called a mandala, which is a physical representation of a vast, pure offering that you're making. It becomes a practice that many people engage in this tradition. That's kind of a preliminary practice. I don't know if anyone else in the room's ever heard any teachings on what to do with broken beads from a mala if you can't rethread it. Or I'm sorry, I don't really have an answer on that one. Again, if you do burn Dharma material, or if you're, even if in the case of something like that, I mean, maybe it's, if you are throwing it away in some way or burning the written pages, to really think that it's going out to create some positive benefit. So as we're burning the pages, it's good to recite this little mantra that's very simple, Om Ahung. Om Ahung represents the enlightened body, speech, and mind of the Buddhas. And so you're kind of blessing it so that maybe you can even visualize that the smoke that's ascending from the burnt pages is going out to enlighten all beings, to bring the Dharma to them. So it becomes a part of our practice, a part of meditation, rather than just simply, you know, like having a bonfire or something, you know, so... So I don't know, with beads, I'm not sure what the best way to deal with them is, but best to maybe find a way to use them in another mala if you can. I don't know. Let's go on to the Sangha jewel then. Again, recognizing that we also depend upon the practitioners that have kind of gone before us, that have developed greater realizations. And so the first one that's proscriptive, having taken refuge in the Sangha, do not cultivate the friendship of people who criticize the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or who have unruly behavior, or do many harmful actions. By becoming friendly with such people, you may be influenced in the wrong way by them. However, that does not mean you should criticize or not have compassion for them. And I think this is the important thing to emphasize. We do have to make some conscious choice about who we associate with, because it does have an effect on us. You know? We can look at various times in our life where we've been negatively impacted by the people we hung out with. Maybe when we were quite young and what have you, we made some bad decisions about who to associate with, and we ended up getting ourselves in a bit of trouble. Well, even in our adult life, there are people who maybe take us somewhat astray. It doesn't mean that we lose our compassion for them. It doesn't mean that even we stop associating with them entirely. We might just have to find ways that we associate with them where we can be quite skillful and make sure that they don't have that negative impact on our lives. But some people we may need to somewhat extricate ourselves from. Now, does that mean that, you know, you should go home, make a list of all the people that you don't want to associate with and unfriend them on Facebook and call them up and tell them never to call you again? I don't think so. I think it just means that you have to start making some decisions about the degree that you're going to be associating with them. You know, if you've got people who are constantly putting negative things out there and you're always having to see them, well, you might have to contend with that and struggle a bit with that. I find that for myself, this is at least my own experience with having taken refuge all those years ago, is that there was almost a natural process that kind of unfurled on the basis of my making a deeper and deeper commitment to this path, that the people who were in my life who were not supportive of that sort of naturally fell away to some degree. I mean, I do have a few people that I still see here and there, but it's maybe just like a once a year sort of getting together. Really not anything that's going to have a negative impact on my life. The other thing to keep in mind is that as your dharma, your refuge in the dharma strengthens, as your practice strengthens, you probably have greater ability to be in the presence of others who might be misleading in some way and not be misled, because you have the strength of your own practice. You're grounded in your own practice. It's very similar to someone who's trying to confront their alcoholism or substance abuse of some sort, right? You know, you don't tell an alcoholic who's trying to get away from alcohol right at the beginning to go hang out with your bar buddies. You know, no, you don't hang out with your bar buddies because they're going to continue to influence you to drink. But if you've been practicing long enough at abstaining from drinking, some people at least, they might get to a place of strength to where they can be with those people again and not have the temptation. It's a similar thing. Again, we all have our different challenges that we have to acknowledge in our lives and make very set decisions about what we're going to expose ourselves to. And this is maybe even beyond people at some level. We're talking mostly about people here in the Sangha Jewel. But I'd say a good part of our practice is also making a decision on what we're going to expose ourselves to in terms of the media, in terms of other activities, even entertainment. You know, we're trying to uphold a particular way of thinking about the world, and a lot of those things have influences too. It's not part of this commitment, but it can be something that's kind of an extension of that, to really look at our lives and what things do we let in that could poison our minds to some degree. If we have strength of mind, then maybe they don't, again, but we each are the guide for ourselves in looking at that. No one else can tell you, you should do this or you shouldn't do that. Here, rather, the advice is being given to help us on our path, to strengthen our commitment, to be careful about who we do associate with, because it can have a very detrimental impact on our path. There was this phrase I mentioned to someone yesterday, I think it was, that with someone who is really kind of great negative quality, they may be able to improve by being in the presence of someone who's in positive quality. But even someone who's got great positive quality could be brought down by someone who has negative quality. So it's kind of, again, each of us having to make a decision for ourselves who we're going to associate with. Again, not turning people away in a really harsh way, not being uncompassionate towards them, but rather trying to hold them in the space of our genuine care and concern, but recognizing that they're no longer really good people for us to associate with. The other side of it that's prescriptive is, it says there, also respect monks and nuns as they are people who are making earnest efforts to actualize the teachings. Respecting them helps your mind, for you appreciate their qualities and are open to learn from their example. By respecting even the robes of ordained beings, you will be happy and inspired when seeing them. So again, this is the idea that what represents the Sangha Jewel in our community is the ordained members of our community, what we generally call the Sangha. This word Sangha gets used in a lot of contexts in different ways in the West, sometimes referring to the whole community, but technically in this tradition we're referring to the ordained members in that way. When we get to a deeper level of what Sangha is, you probably got this from Shankha in one of the earlier teachings, the Sangha jewel is really, you know, the beings who possess these realizations and the realizations in their minds. So while we might conventionally hold the ordained people to be representative of that, there's no guarantee that the ordained people have those levels of realizations. Maybe lay people have those realizations. We don't know who has those realizations. Where our ultimate Sangha jewel is are in those realizations and the people that hold them. Whereas on a conventional level, it's fine to see those who are ordained, who are holding the vows that the Buddha gave to ordained practitioners 2,500 some years ago as representative of the Sangha jewel in our lives. So again, this doesn't mean that every person who's got robes on is of that level of realization, nor even necessarily going to be perfectly qualified to guide us. It simply means that we're going to hold a respectful attitude towards them. And we do that a lot by our behavior in this tradition, by allowing them to be seated first, allowing them to be given food first, all of these sorts of practices that help us to maintain that respect for the Sangha jewel. So, questions on that, on any of these actually for the first six that are specific to each of the three jewels? No questions. By the way, I'm assuming, I don't know how Friday night will go when you do the refuge ceremony, but I'm sure Geshe Gelug will be open to questions too. Don't feel like this is your last chance. When Geshe Sherab, who's our resident Geshe for the 6 months of the year that I'm away, when he gives refuge, he always opens it up and even talks a little bit about refuge before he does it, which I'm sure Geshe Gelug will do as well to some degree. So don't feel like this is your last chance to ask these questions, but again, I would encourage you to do some additional reading if you haven't already to make sure that you're familiar with these. The six common guidelines that are on the latter part of the page, mindful of the qualities, skills, and differences between the three jewels, which is something you've been studying as part of this module, looking at what each of the three jewels are, what their qualities are, what abilities they possess. So being mindful of that and other, you know, of the three jewels and other possible refuges, repeatedly take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So this means that, you know, it doesn't mean that you repeatedly say the words, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma. It means that you come from a place of refuge in how you live your life. It means that what you are doing is upholding the refuge by being mindful of the three jewels as your, I really, again, like that term, safe direction. It is what is providing you to have safe direction in your life. So there is a part of this, it's actually the fourth one on this, that does encourage you to make a verbal representation of that refuge by reciting a formula for asserting refuge, just like the one that we did at the beginning of class tonight. But this one is more about that this is really how you want to live your life. It's with that mindfulness of the three jewels and repeatedly in your everyday actions, taking refuge by following the Buddha as the one who gave the advice, the Dharma as the advice itself, and the Sangha as those who give us aid in applying those in our lives, following that advice. The second one is remembering their kindness, make offerings to them, especially offering your food before eating. They often say the first part of your food. There's prayers for doing this. In the book that you have, the prayer booklet on page 207, I believe it is, should be the food prayers, the food offering prayers. Yeah, 207 to 208. These are one formula for doing that, but you can come up with your own way. It's not like it has to be a particular way. These are used in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition as a way of offering our food. And you can see right there in that first prayer that we include the guru in that. This is going to be the topic of that next module, module 4, when you look at the spiritual teacher, the guru, the lama. You know, that person who plays a special role, or persons who play a special role in your spiritual development, who is the embodiment of the three jewels in your life, which again you'll be exploring in that next module. But the idea is to have some respect for the three jewels and by recalling their kindness to think about offering the first part of your food to them. So you say these sorts of prayers and you think that you are offering it to them. It doesn't mean that you actually take that first bit of, you know, salad and you put it on your altar or something in front of the Buddha statue. It means that you have that thought while you are partaking of that food, of offering it to the Three Jewels. Now, also, it's good to make other offerings. This is where, again, you'll learn that in Module 8 when you look at establishing a daily practice about making water bowl offerings. You can offer anything, though. You know, if you've got beautiful flowers in your garden now in the growing season, it's nice to take some flowers and put them in a nice vase and put them in front of your Buddha statue or Buddha picture, image, whatever you have. These are nice ways of, again, showing our reverence and our concern for wanting to keep that active in our lives. It's like keeping the flame lit, keeping it all kind of flowing in regard to our relationship to the Three Jewels. Any questions on those two? Okay, let's go on to number three. Mindful of their compassion, encourage others to take refuge in the Three Jewels. So there here is the Three Jewels. Just like in the second one, remembering their kindness is the kindness of the Three Jewels. Mindful of the compassion of the Three Jewels, that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are all products of compassion, are all imbued with compassion. So mindful of that, they're about trying to relieve the suffering of other beings, right? The Three Jewels exist solely for the purpose of relieving the suffering of beings. Everything the Buddha taught was for the purpose of relieving the suffering of beings. So we should, as much as possible, encourage others to take refuge in the Three Jewels. This doesn't mean we go around door to door and say, you know, leave little packets with people and say, I'd like to talk to you about, you know, refuge in the Three Jewels today. Do you have a moment? You know, this isn't what we do in Buddhism, is proselytize from door to door. It just means that we try to encourage, where we can, those who have taken refuge and are part of our community, to renew that continually through how they behave, how they are in the world. Giving them guidance when we can, skillfully, not harshly or critically, but rather encouraging each other on our path. And then those who don't have refuge in the Three Jewels, to try to encourage them to adopt what might be suitable of the Buddhist teachings in their lives. Many of us don't see ourselves as teachers, but we are teachers. We're teachers by example and teachers by everything that we say. We talked a bit about speech yesterday in the weekend course. Our speech is the main way that we connect with others, right? So we have to be mindful about how we talk to others and try to help them when we can with our speech. Yeah. We may not need to say, well, oh, you know, I want to give you a Buddhist teaching right now. That might not be the most useful thing to say, but if somebody, a friend calls you and they're really distressed about something, you might say, well, I have something I'd like to share with you. Would that be okay? And they might say, well, yeah, that would be nice. And you say, well, maybe, have you looked at it this way? And we might share some of what the Buddha taught. We don't even have to say it's Buddha Dharma. I'm not trying to make it like Buddhism by stealth. I'm just saying, you know, make sure that what we give to them can be received and can be useful for them to begin to see that there's other ways to look at things, other ways to live their lives. Eventually that may plant the seed that allows them to find some sense of safe direction and refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in the way that we have. They might think, you know, maybe they have good results from that, and they call you back up and say, you know, that advice you gave me, you know, that was really great. And you say, well, actually, I got that from my teachings at the Kadampa Center. You know, and you can give people what they need then in that way. So again, this doesn't mean that we're like force-feeding Buddhism to everybody around us. We're making them take refuge. But rather that we're encouraging others to find their own sense of, again, safe direction as much as possible in teachings that align with the Dharma, at least, if not our, you know, the Dharma as it's presented. I mean, I even find frequently it's really helpful if you know somebody's already firmly grounded in another spiritual tradition, well, then help them to practice their spiritual tradition well. Help them to be in touch with the teachings of Christ or the teachings of Muhammad or whatever faith that they follow. You know, I think that's part of upholding refuge too. It's helping people to see truth and genuine, you know, aid in the teachings that they can find, that once more are part of the overarching thing that the Buddhas are involved in, all these, you know, very powerful techniques of helping sentient beings to be free from suffering. The fourth one is where we do get into these benefits, so we're going to, in a moment, go to that other handout. Remembering the benefits of taking refuge, do so three times. in the morning and three times in the evening by reciting and reflecting upon any of the refuge prayers. And I put in parentheses here, these can be found in many practice texts and are also in Kathleen McDonald's How to Meditate. Why I put that on there is because many people who do Discovering Buddhism have that book from Module 2 on how to meditate. And it's in the sections on prayers that's on that group of pages there. Again, I think that's probably the most recent volume of that. But you'll find the prayer section and you'll see for sure this verse that encapsulates refuge. But once again, there's many different formulas for that. They might take slightly different shape in different texts. But what you're trying to do by doing that is not just recite the words. Reciting the words could be just, you know, meaningless chatter. You could teach a parrot to recite the words of refuge, right? We want to make sure there's some meaning behind it. And that's why remembering the benefits of refuge is useful. Because then we actually bring those to mind as we're reciting these words. We really think that I'm doing this because of these various benefits. I don't have time. We've only got about another 13 minutes, so I don't want to go through all of these individually, but they're very self-explanatory to some degree. I might touch on a few of these. The first benefit, again, on this meditation that I put together, on you become a Buddhist or an inner being. This means that, again, you're accepting the responsibility for your own well-being lies within yourself. You're not going to put blame or look to other people to solve all your problems. The reality is that you are the one in charge. This is what it means to be a Buddhist, is to be an inner being, to look within ourselves for the sources of our well-being. The second one, the basis of all ordinations, this is where, again, this is the basis for taking any other vows, what are called the pratimoksha, or individual liberation vows, which include the five lay vows, as well as all the monastic vows, are the first level of vows that one can take on the basis of refuge. And I'm pretty sure, again, that Geshe Gelug is offering those five lay vows as part of refuge this Friday. Yes? Okay. And do you know if he offers them with the option of taking any number of them? Is that how he usually does that? Okay. Most of the teachers in our tradition do that. And so he may give you more specific advice on how to hold those, and it's probably best for him to do that, because some of them, especially the last one, might be interpreted differently by different teachers. But it's really good to study those five vows. They are essentially to refrain from killing, which essentially means, in a general way, it means not killing any being. In a very specific way, it's especially not killing human beings, because that is how we actually lose that vow from the root. Actually, if you want to open your prayer book now to that same page where you were probably on 117. This is where the five lay vows are set out. So again, you lose the vow from the root if you kill a human being. Nonetheless, you also transgress the vow and kind of weaken it by having a downfall if you kill a non-human, you know, an animal, an insect, any being. So again, we should try as best as possible when we take that vow to avoid that transgression, that downfall. Secondly, taking that which has not been given, that's stealing. Again, we lose that from the vow or from the root if we steal an object that is valuable, and then we have a transgression or a weakening, a downfall, if we steal an object of no value or of, you know, pretty inconsequential value, like a post-it or a paperclip, or, you know, even a pen, I think, for most people, unless it's a really expensive pen. You know, these sorts of things that, again, are generally a pretty nominal value. But value is frequently in the eye of the beholder, so we should be careful with that one. Always ask for anything that we take. Sexual misconduct. Here, you lose the vow from the root by engaging in sexual activities with another's partner, what we call adultery. The weakening of it through a downfall is a variety of things, and you can take a look at those. And those are primarily rooted in concepts around keeping our sexual behavior, particularly to, you know, divorced from things like holy places and on holy days and so on, that sort of thing. The fourth one, telling lies, the only way that you lose it is if you tell a supreme lie, saying that you've attained various realizations that you haven't. And then the other way that the fourth one is a downfall is when we tell ordinary lies, when we tell things that deceive others that are not, you know, I've realized emptiness kind of things. You know, if we say that and we haven't actually achieved that, that would be a supreme lie. Drinking alcohol is an interesting one. That's, again, the one that you should probably check with Geshe Gelug to see how he is giving that. I think different teachers in our tradition give it in slightly different ways. Frequently includes intoxicants other than alcohol. It doesn't seem, from my own discussion with some of the people in the education department, that you can lose the vow from the root, but rather that you only receive downfalls every time that you break that. However, we should be careful with that because, again, we shouldn't take that vow if we really think that we're going to go against the wishes of the preceptor. And it's up to, again, the preceptor to determine exactly how that vow is given. The first time I took it wasn't in this tradition. It was with a Nyingma Lama, Penner Rinpoche, and he gave it to Westerners as you shouldn't get intoxicated rather than you shouldn't drink at all. But that's, again, in the eyes of the preceptor. And if you take it through the lens of what the preceptor is saying, then you have to uphold it based on what the preceptor is saying. If it's given as you're never to have alcohol again, then we have to take it with that intention, or in other intoxicants for that matter. But know that, again, you have to take refuge to take that level of vows. You have to take refuge to take the bodhisattva vows, which is the Mahayana vows that are taught, that uphold the mind of enlightenment and our attainment of that state. And then even to take tantric vows, you have to have refuge, of course, which is a much, much further down the path for many of you, I'm sure. So any questions on that? I really just wanted to touch on these briefly. Yes, right in front of you there. What's your name, by the way, who is asking the question?
Katie.
Hi, Katie.
So it says, like, for the not killing, does that include, like, eating meat and stuff?
Right. It's always a question that comes up, and the way that it's generally framed is that you are not engaged in the act of killing when you're eating meat. You're eating meat because someone else has killed the being, sure, but you're primarily about an act of putting food into your mouth, might be with attachment, might be with a lot of other delusions present, but it's not an act of killing. If you've studied, were you here for the module on karma, module 6?
Yeah.
So we looked at karma, I'm sure, and as part of that, the karma of killing, and the act of killing itself is one where we first have the being there in front of us that is going to be killed, that we see and recognize as the being we want to kill, that we have the intention to kill, and that we have a delusion behind why we're killing it. Then we go on to engage in the actual act or ask someone else to engage in the act, and then the animal dies. You know, that is like how it is a complete act of killing. So it seems that you're not involved in any of that kind of act when you're sitting down and eating meat. Now, sure, another being was involved in that killing because someone else caused the taking of the life of that being. You're complicit to some degree, but you are actually not engaging in the act of killing. This is one perspective. I'm not saying this is absolute. And I think it's good to have a sense of reverence, to think maybe for me, taking that vow means I need to distance myself from killing completely by not being engaged in eating meat. But it's not by any means a requirement for taking that vow. And again, as far as I know, I don't think Geshe Gelug would give it in that context. I don't think most Tibetan lamas give that vow in that context. Even in the time of the Buddha, the monks that have that same vow would eat meat if it was offered to them. They didn't go out and take the lives of those beings, but they would go with their begging bowl, and monks still do this today, you know, to receive alms. And if meat is put in their dish, they eat that meat. They don't say, I can't eat that meat because of this particular precept.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. All right, Katie. Thanks for that question. I know it comes up frequently. I think the whole thing on whether one stops eating meat or not, again, is a bigger issue that we can spend time talking on, but I don't think we have the time to do that. But it's good to research this a bit. You can actually go to the FPMT's website and research this. There's one article in Mandala magazine many years ago where Venerable Sangye Kadro took the position of it's good not to eat meat, and the rationale behind that, and Venerable Robina, I think, was the one who took the opposite position about eating meat. And there's different perspectives on it, and it's good to explore that and evolve to where you need to in regard to that. Every practitioner is going to be somewhat different. Should we go on? Okay. In regard to the rest of the benefits of taking refuge, what I want to say about the rest of them is know that some of these, again, have to do with the fact that what does it really mean to take refuge? If you looked at number 5, for example, there, the fifth benefit, it says that you will not be afflicted by the harmful actions of humans or non-humans once you take refuge. Does that mean that if a snake bites you after you've taken refuge, that there's something wrong, you know, that I mustn't have taken refuge? Well, it means that you are going to be dedicated to a path that will eventually remove all these types of hindrances. Why? Because you're going to be following the Dharma. You're not going to be creating negative karma. You're not going to have those negative influences in your life. This is how the Dharma works. This is the level of confidence we should have in the Dharma, is that the Dharma will lead to the end of your suffering. So it doesn't mean that this is an instant thing. Oh, I went to the refuge ceremony on Friday and then a wasp bit me on Saturday, so there must be something wrong with this refuge formula. Well, no. You know, this is a process. Again, you're doing refuge. And if you are doing refuge sincerely in your heart by the power of your refuge, you will be able to counteract all those forces. It's not instant. You know, none of this is instant. If it was instant, you know, it would be wonderful, right? You could do it like that, instantly become a Buddha. So it's the same for these other ones. You will not fall into the lower realms. Effortlessly achieve all your temporary and long-term aims. Attain enlightenment quickly. Well, it's all in regard to the extent to which you continue to do refuge, continue to be dedicated to these teachings. The benefits unfold as that becomes your way of life, as that becomes your bottom line, and always going back to, how am I following the Dharma? How am I being in line with what the Buddha wants in terms of, or advises in terms of behavior? How am I in accord with what the Sangha advises that I do? As long as we keep that as our measure of what we're doing, you will continue to see all these various benefits. Okay. Let's go back then to the refuge commitments and conclude with these last two, since we only have a few minutes. Do all actions by entrusting yourself to the three jewels. This means that once again, everything that we engage in, we should try to bring that awareness to it. A bit of like what I was just discussing, thinking about, you could use that phrase, you know, what would Buddha do? Well, what does it mean to be a Buddhist in this moment when I'm confronted with somebody who's annoying me on the freeway? You know, how do I actually take refuge to the three jewels and trust myself to the three jewels in that moment? And then the final one, which, as I said, Lama Tsongkhapa, who is the great teacher of this Gelugpa tradition, says that this is really the only one that causes us to actually break our refuge, is if we forsake our refuge for the cost of our life or as a joke, which we shouldn't even do. We shouldn't even make, you know, this in jest that we're giving up our refuge. Rather, we should always be sincere in trying to uphold that. And that's why, again, we should feel somewhat serious about our own sense of refuge before doing it in a formal way. It's not essential, again, to take refuge in a formal way to have taken refuge. Taking refuge once more is something we do in our hearts. But once we've done that in our hearts, and even through ceremony, such as what Geshe-la will do on Friday, we should feel that this is our bottom line now going forward. This is how we are going to live our lives. I think we have to be, again, as content with that as we can. I did hear a story. I'm not saying this to discourage anybody. I'm just, you know, giving you the reality that we still don't know what our lives have in store for us. There was one man I heard about who had taken refuge as a Zen practitioner. It was 25 years later that he came to the conclusion, having grown up Christian prior to taking refuge, that he actually had his true refuge in Christ and turned away from that. It's just, this stuff happens. You know, we might have influences in our lives that take us in a different direction. And we might not be able to foresee that. But to the best of your ability right now, that should really be one of the things that you feel you can uphold. You can say, I'm not going to forsake this path because I have that level of confidence right now. Remember how confidence in the three jewels to protect us is one of our two main causes of refuge. The first one being having some level of fear or trepidation about our future experiences and our next rebirths in samsara in terms of the suffering of all beings and our wish to continue to benefit them. So if we have some trepidation and we see that the three jewels are actually our protector in regard to that, and we have that confidence, then we probably won't do number six. We won't forsake our refuge. It will continue to grow and develop, and we'll feel quite content in it. And that it's opening again to greater and greater potential within ourselves, greater and greater happiness for ourselves and for those around us. So I don't know, that was one way of presenting these. I'm sure you can find other presentations, again, in books that will give you more details on each of these. But I'm hoping it's been useful just to take a look at this whole process and what it really means in terms of the sorts of behaviors, again, that will uphold our refuge and strengthen our refuge. And that's really how we should see these, not as a list of do's and don'ts. You know, this is a list of what will actually cause you to grow as a Buddhist, as a being who is dedicated to this path. So any questions, comments, criticisms? Yes, Erin.
May I just make a quick announcement?
Absolutely.
And then we can do a question. If you're coming to all the classes in this module, we have one more class next week, June 12th. That's our last class. There will be a test. The test is in the back of the room, so go ahead and get it and think about it. The questions are more thinking questions than memorizing questions. Bring it back with you on June 12th. I'll also have copies on June 12th. There are also copies online for anyone listening on the Discovering Buddhism material page.
Great.
So we'll just, you'll want that tonight before you go.
Good. Wonderful. Thanks, Sarah.
The next module after that starts after July 4th.
Yeah.
After whatever the Monday after July 4th is, and then we have about 3 weeks of that module, and then not again until the end of September after Light of the Path retreat.
It's probably July 10th, I think.
We have a question about what is the next module that starts in September. Would that be daily practice, Donna?
That would be module 8, probably if you...
Yeah, we did like 1, 2, 3, 4, 7, 5, 1, 2,
3, 5, 7,
6,
5,
7,
6, 7.
4, 6, 7, yeah. Something like that.
That's how I teach it, actually. I mean, I actually find that it's really useful to do module 4 after this one, at least to have some concept of what refuge means before we start talking about a spiritual guide, which is a real direct personal refuge in our lives. So.
Okay, Death and Rebirth.
Oh, Death and Rebirth. You didn't do Death and Rebirth then. Okay.
Yeah.
We missed, is that 5? I think we missed.
Yeah, five. Skipped over 5.
We're like Camelback.
Okay, we do have another question.
So if you have an animal like a rat and you're doing a medical or scientific experiment on it, like rats they use to cure like diabetes and stuff like that. So in that case, if the animal would be killed or would be injured, would that set bad karma?
And it's Eric, right? Yes. Thanks, Eric, for your question. Well, again, we live in a complicated world, and there are a lot of animals that are used for that type of purpose, and beings, human beings that are involved in inflicting that harm on the animal with a motivation of trying to help human beings. The problem is that when we ever get into a place where we're harming one being to help another being, it's there's not a lot of equanimity there. This word equanimity that we use frequently, Eric, in our teachings means that we have kind of an equal regard for all beings. Now, again, in our culture, we do tend to, and even sometimes in the Buddhist teachings, you hear about human beings being a superior state to animals. But it doesn't mean that at the level of their lives that they are to be disrespected and human beings to be respected more, but rather to understand that as a human being, we have great potential, and as an animal, maybe not as much potential to use that life meaningfully. So if we can avoid harming any being, regardless of whether it's a human or an animal, we should do that. And there's issues that become very complex, like I said, the one that you described, where you're actually using that animal's as a means of testing things that will benefit and save human beings. But again, it becomes quite short-sighted because it's only looking at benefiting those types of beings while there's a detriment to other beings, to the rats or the monkeys or whatever it is that are being used for those experiments. So as a Buddhist, and we talked about this a little over the weekend, right, about trying to avoid ways of making our living that are not so beneficial, that are harming others, we would probably not want to be involved in that as a Buddhist if we could. It would be nice if we could not be the person doing that. Because it isn't such a good action to be doing. Now, if you do have to do that, you want to try to have compassion for the rat and the monkey and whoever else, as well as the beings that will benefit from that experiment. As much as possible, hold them in the space of that compassion so that your action at least has that motivation behind it. So it's tricky. It's very hard to say exactly, but in general, that type of action is harming another being and would be non-virtuous, would be bad, negative karma. What do you think of that answer? Is it okay? Okay. These are tricky ones. I mean, this is, you know, part of our culture that is very hard to divorce ourselves from. But and many of us benefit from what has been done in the past that has utilized animals as, you know, the basis for research and so on. Yeah, Katie?
Going off what he said, what about putting pets to sleep when they're sick and, like, suffering?
Yeah, euthanizing pets. I'm not going to talk a whole lot about that, but there's also a wonderful article where Lama Zopa gave advice to someone specifically who wanted to euthanize their pet. I think we have to once more go back to, we have to examine our motivation. Why are we doing that? Are we really holding compassion for that being? Or is it quite mixed? Generally, people are not going to euthanize a pet if they don't have kind of completely divorced from compassion for the being, because usually it's motivated by seeing the suffering of one's dog or cat or whatever the pet is and not wanting to see them continue to suffer. But frequently there's also this other side of it, which is the pain that it causes us that we're not so comfortable with, or the discomfort of having a sick animal at home and all the complications of that. So I think if we're going to engage in that type of action and ask a veterinarian to euthanize a pet for us, we have to be really clear about having compassion for that being at the greatest level. And Lama Zopa says something somewhat similar in this article. He also gives a little practice you can do if you want to sort of turn it over to the Buddhas, in a sense, a little practice around Green Tara, this female Buddha, that is kind of a nice way to approach it, to feel that you're going to follow the advice that this little practice gives you, regardless of whether it says euthanize the pet or keep the pet and allow it to go through that process. Many teachers will say that there is a karmic consequence to some degree of allowing it to go through the death process and to not take its life before all that's complete. But I think once more, if our compassion is really quite strong, it can be, again, an excusable action, an action that can actually be quite beneficial. But it really depends upon the circumstances so much, so it's hard to give a black and white answer, yes or no. I'd really encourage you to, it's actually called Euthanasia with a Good Heart, is the article that was in Mandala magazine. I don't have it in front of me, or I'd be happy to, you know, offer that to you. But we have another question, or is this it? Any last question? Well, I really thank you all for your attention tonight. Let's do just a few prayers to dedicate and close off this evening. I'm assuming you probably do the two prayers on 235 that we normally do, or which ones do you do? 246?
Yeah, we do the Shanti Deva quite often.
Okay, let's do this on page 246. Again, this is the words that are around our strong intentions through what we've done here tonight, all the thoughts that we've had, all the seeds that we've planted, wanting to bring about the greatest benefit, both temporally and ultimately, for all sentient beings. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid. May those bound be freed. May the powerless find power. And may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Okay, thank you all again for your attention and being here tonight. And I wish you well, those of you who are taking refuge. Hope it is very fruitful for you, and enjoy your ceremony on Friday. Okay, thank you.